TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. John Campbell, Coronavirus, What We Need to Know Now. Interview by Radio EcoShock host Alex Smith. In the first week of March 2020, as the world was trying to understand the new coronavirus, this extraordinary conversation was posted in the weekly lineup of Radio EcoShock. My fellow broadcaster and friend Alex Smith reached Dr. John Campbell in Britain and asked him about the medical science and epidemiology of the virus. Dr. Campbell also publishes almost daily on YouTube under Campbell Teaching, and a film posted yesterday had 250,000 views in 24 hours. Alex Smith gave me permission to broadcast excerpts from this information-packed one-hour radio program from EcoShock. Here's Alex.
With his daily briefings on the novel coronavirus, Dr. John Campbell has become a YouTube teacher for the world. Recently, John has appeared on radio from Germany to Australia. He is a man made for the hour, I think. John is a British retired nurse teacher. After teaching nurses in several countries, John got his doctorate on open learning for medical training. No wonder he draws it all out so professionally for hundreds of thousands of YouTube viewers. From Britain, Dr. John Campbell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alec.
Now, speaking as we are in the first week of March, in a rapidly evolving scene, it's changing every day, what do you see as the outlook for this new disease in Britain?
Well, I think the chief medical officer in my country is of the opinion, and the prime minister is of the opinion, that it's overwhelmingly likely we're going to see more cases. Now, the big concern is what will happen is we'll follow patterns that have happened in China, Iran, South Korea, and Italy, where the isolated cases became clusters, and the clusters went on from being isolated cases to clusters to community spread. This is the big concern. Now, community spread means that the virus is going from person to person, and we can't really follow that epidemiologically. We can't relate that back to a particular epicenter of the infection. So with community spread, cases of the virus will just pop up, and we won't probably be able to work out where they came from. And that means that we're kind of out of the containment stage into the delay stage, where we try and delay it for as long as we can. But that's unfortunately what I fear is going to happen, that we're going to see cases popping up as a result of community transmission. And this is likely to occur because of the fact that this virus is transmissible from people that are asymptomatic, that means without symptoms, or people that are pre-symptomatic before they develop symptoms, or people that develop only a very mild illness. And even though they have a very mild illness themselves, they can still be infectious and spread the virus onto other people who can subsequently develop a more severe illness.
What's the advantage to delaying it, though, John? Maybe we just let it run its course and get it over with.
What likely happens in epidemics is that quite a large proportion of the population will be infected. So the chief medical officer in my country estimates about 80% as being the upper number. The number of people that are likely to be infected in my country, and indeed globally, unfortunately, is likely to be 60 to 80%. Now, some of these will have very mild disease. Perhaps half of those will have very mild disease. But another half will have symptomatic disease, bad enough to be off work sick for a few days. But a proportion of these, perhaps around about 12%, will have more severe, serious disease that requires some medical treatment, such as giving intravenous antibiotics, supplementary oxygen, or intravenous fluids. Now, if it's 12% of about 30% of the population, that's actually an awful lot of people. And we would really struggle in terms of healthcare provision to treat all of those should they become ill all at the same time. So what we want to do is, we can't really stop it from spreading, but we want the people that are getting severe illness to be spread out as much as possible. So that gives us a much better chance of being able to give them effective medical treatment. Now, if we can give them effective medical treatment, that is going to reduce the overall case fatality. because effective medical treatment makes someone much more likely to survive a severe infection with the illness, a severe symptomatic illness, than they would without the medical support. We can't actually treat the virus itself, but we can do an awful lot of things to support people while they're critically ill. So we need to spread that out as much as possible. So what we don't want is a big peak of infections that goes up quickly, then will go down quickly. We'd much rather have a sort of slower, gradual bump so that we spread the infections out over a year rather than over just a few weeks. And then we'll be able to manage the situation much more effectively medically. And it will also mean that a much smaller proportion of the working population is off sick at any one time. So, for example, if 50% of the people that were going to get the virus got the infection in a 3 or 4 week period, as some models predict, then an awful lot of the workforce would be off sick at any one time. And, of course, that's going to include healthcare professionals as well. Whereas if we can delay it and spread out the amount of people that get the infection over a longer period of time, it will become much more manageable. So that's what we need to aim for.
John, it seems this virus is more successful in a contained community where it can create clusters, whether it's a cruise ship or a nursing home. I wonder, can a single virus infect us, in which case personal protection would be pretty unlikely, or does it take a certain load to enter our systems and cause this disease? What do you think?
That's a very good question. Now, this is a novel virus. It was only first identified in December. So normally, the likelihood of getting an infection depends on the number of viral particles someone's exposed to, or indeed the number of bacterial particles, but viral particles in this case, the virulence of that virus or bacteria, and the state of the host's defenses. So the infective dose of the virus is going to be different depending on the individual it's infecting and their host defenses. So, for example, someone with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease who is not able to clear sputum out of their lungs effectively, probably a relatively small number of viruses would be needed to infect those, because those viruses would not be cleared from the lungs by the cilia and the mucus and the coughing the virus and the sputum up. Whereas someone with a healthy respiratory tract, you'd probably need a larger number of viruses to cause the infection. Now, we don't know what the number of viruses is. In theory, yes, one virus could cause the infection if it gets down into the lower parts of the airways. In practice, I suspect we're talking about a larger dose than that, but those figures just haven't been quantified yet, and we don't know that.
Well, look, this sounds like a good opportunity. If you could explain to us where this virus goes in the lungs and how it damages our ability to live.
So a virus is what you call an obligate intracellular parasite. That means a virus can only reproduce inside a living human cell, in this case, a living human cell. So this virus is only transmitted from human cell to human cell. It cannot reproduce on its own like a bacteria. And a virus can only reproduce inside a human cell if it gets into the cell, if it has some way of getting into the cell. And the way a virus gets into the cell, this particular virus, there's something called a spike protein. And that spike protein fits into a particular receptor on the surface of our cells. It's the only way it can get in. It's a bit like putting a key in a lock. So the virus would be the key and the receptor would be the lock. And the particular receptor that the COVID-19 virus fits into is called an ACE2 receptor, an angiotensin converting enzyme receptor type 2. And these are found in the lower parts of the airways particularly. So there's not so many in the upper airways, but they're in the lower airways. The virus will lock onto these receptor sites. That will facilitate the entrance of the virus into the cell. After the virus absorbs onto this receptor site, the virus will go into the cell. And the virus will then start reproducing inside the cell because the virus will take over the genetic apparatus of the cell. That's what the viruses do. They hijack the genetic apparatus of the cell to force the cell to make new viral particles. Instead of making new cell proteins, it's making new viral proteins. And then after a period of time, those viruses will start budding from the surface of the cell. And they will bud into the lumen, into the hole down the middle of the respiratory tract, in the bronchioles, in the small bronchial passages. And that will get into the mucus, and that will be wafted up into the upper parts of the airway, where the virus will be shed by coughing and sneezing. And to some extent, just breathing out. It's what we call a droplet infection. It's certainly a droplet infection. Now, the problem is that the virus, when the virus is reproducing inside the cell eventually the virus will take over so much of the cell's protein-producing apparatus that it will kill the cell. So the virus itself can kill the cell. That means you start killing cells in the lower part of the respiratory airways. As well as that, when the cell is infected with a virus, viral particles will go to the surface of the cell, and the body's own immune system will actually kill the cells that are infected with the virus, again, causing damage to the respiratory epithelium. Now, that damage has two effects. The first effect is the damaged respiratory epithelial surface provides an ideal place for bacteria to live, so we can get bacterial secondary infection, and that can lead to pneumonia. But as well as that, the presence of the virus and all this cell destroying that's going on leads to a lot of inflammation. And the inflammation causes the capillaries in the area to become leaky. And the capillaries will leak and fluids will start leaking into the tissue spaces in the lungs. And eventually fluid will collect in the alveolar air spaces, the small air spaces over which gaseous exchange takes place. They will gradually fill up with fluid. And if the alveoli are full of fluid, that means the oxygen can't get in, and it also means the carbon dioxide can't get out. So the levels of oxygen in the blood would start to drop. That's a condition called hypoxemia. And the low levels of oxygen in the blood means there'll be low levels of oxygen to all the tissues of the body, such as the heart, the kidneys, the liver, the brain. That's called hypoxia. And the hypoxia will start damaging essential organs. And when these inflammatory changes cause the fluid to start accumulating in the tissue fluid in the lungs and in the alveolar air spaces in the lungs, that's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. So the mechanism of death will be, or severe illness will be ARDS, with the lungs filling with inflammatory fluid, bacterial secondary infection, which we can treat. And the other mechanism is viral pneumonia. So the presence of the virus in the lungs, again, will cause inflammatory changes due to the infection this time rather than due to the inflammation. And again, the alveoli will fill up with inflammatory fluid, and that will stop the exchange of gases. So basically, if you want to be put it fairly melodramatically, people will be drowning because the alveolar air spaces in the lungs are full of fluid. And the other thing that can happen is because the virus stimulates the immune system can release particular, the cells in the immune system can release particular chemicals called cytokines. And that can cause what's called a cytokine storm. And that presents as sepsis with a high respiratory rate, high pulse rate, high fever, high blood sugar levels, altered mental status, and alterations in the amount of white cells in the blood and increase in the amount of lactic acid in the blood. So that's another possible complication. So there's quite a few ways that this virus can get you if there is a severe infection, especially if it's causing these inflammatory changes in the lower tissues of the lungs, in the lower airways.
Now, in Western countries, most of the people who have died are seniors, many with pre-existing conditions, as you mentioned. But are there cases where healthy people, even young people, can die from this disease?
There are. Now, the death rate increases greatly with increasing age. So the death rate is going to be higher in people in there. It starts going up in about the 50s. So people 50 to 60 are going to die more than younger people. People 60 to 70 are going to die more than younger people. And it goes up with increasing age until the death rate over the age of 80 is really quite high. Now, this is partly because as people age, the immune system becomes less efficient and less able to combat the virus. But as well as that, as people age, the probability that they will have other diseases as well increases. These are called comorbidities. So people in their 70s and 80s are much more likely to have heart failure, diabetes mellitus type 2, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, chronic renal failure, hypertension, and all these other diseases that are commonly associated with older age. And these comorbidities are also going to reduce the level of immunity that people have, making infection more likely. But as well as that, they're going to make serious disease more likely to occur with complications. So it's partly age, and it's partly comorbidities. And there haven't been any studies so far that have dissected this apart. So whether it's primarily the increased case fatality rate is primarily as a result of increasing age or primarily as a result of the comorbidities isn't clear, but both are probably relevant. Now, your question about younger people being affected is, so far, the data that we have from China, now the Chinese have done quite large epidemiological studies on this now, it shows the death rate in children seems to be much lower. Now, we're not quite sure whether the infection rate in children is lower, that the children are less likely to get infected, or whether it's children get a less severe form of the disease, or a combination of those two things. But we're certainly very grateful for the fact that this doesn't seem to be affecting children particularly. Now, this is actually in contrast to previous epidemics, such as the 1918 pandemic of influenza, where young people were disproportionately affected. This doesn't seem to be like that, so that's good. Now, you're right in saying that young fit adults have caught this disease. Perhaps the most famous case is Dr. Li in China, who was the original whistleblower who was suppressed by the local Chinese authorities and tragically went on to die from the disease when I think he was 33. Now, there was different factors there. He was certainly exhausted and extreme tiredness. And we know that lack of sleep can reduce the efficiency of the immune system. So that might have been a factor. It may well have been because he was working clinically, he was exposed to a lot of other organisms as well. So he may well have been exposed to influenza as well as COVID-19, for example. And if you get the two viral infections at the same time, then that's going to reduce the ability of the immune system to fight both of those to some extent. So it may be that he had multiple infections at the same time. So generally speaking, younger people have a much lower case fatality rate. But it may be that if someone has multiple infections at the same time, that's going to increase the risk of fatality. Again, the precise research data on this has not yet been done to be able to pick apart exactly what are the risk factors in younger people. But if we take the whole younger age group, some studies in China, for example, have shown that people in roughly the 20 to 40 age group, their case fatality rate is about 0.2%, whereas that goes up progressively with increasing age.
And we have talked about clusters and this virus, and America has the world's largest prison system with about 2.2 million people in jails. And if the prisons get infected, the choices look bleak as far as I can see. The guards and support people will be reduced by their own illness and quarantines and workers staying home. I notice Iran temporarily, they say, freed 54,000 prisoners. And then we have army barracks and nursing homes and mental hospitals and more. Should we be trying to empty these places out? What do you think, John?
This has been a concern since the start of this epidemic, that there's going to be institutional spread. So such places as students, halls of residence, as you rightly say, prisons. Now, there was a case in Seattle recently where there was quite a large outbreak in a nursing facility for people with chronic conditions. And that resulted in high fatality because, again, you've got a lot of people living quite closely together. And there's been prison outbreaks in China and, as you correctly say, in Iran. So anywhere where people are living, especially indoors, and a lot of people in a confined area, there's going to be a greatly increased risk. So prisons in the United States are certainly at significant risk. If you get one or two cases in a prison, then it's likely to spread through the entire prison and infect maybe 60 to 80% of the people in that prison. I mean, certainly if you can reduce the density of people in the prisons, that would be a very expedient move. But if that's not possible, if the people have to stay in the prisons, then we certainly need very good regulation of people going in and out so that people who are potentially infected are not coming into contact with the people in the prison. But, of course, that's very difficult to do because people can have a fever that then you might recognize that they're symptomatic and might be infected. But, of course, as we've already said, many people get a very mild version of the disease and people can be infectious before they are symptomatic, before they're feeling unwell, but still spreading the disease. And one of the problems in the United States has been that testing has not been quite as on the ball as we would like it to have been. Now, I did notice that there's a political declaration today to introduce huge numbers of tests. that can be carried out locally in the United States. But up until this point, testing in the United States, as I understand it, has been done entirely by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. And there hasn't been a huge amount of testing done. For example, the Chinese are currently carrying out 1.5 million tests per week. The South Koreans have carried out 100,000 tests. The Italians have carried out 20,000 tests. But I think the total number in America is dramatically less than that. So cases have been missed in the States, and it's quite possible that, this virus could already be in prisons. I don't know that yet. But it's certainly a very high-risk environment, and we're going to need it to work out some way to maintain order. And it is going to be a problem, because, and as you rightly say, staff are going to be involved as well as inmates. It is quite a big concern. I think some political decisions may have to be taken.
And you've also spoken about the after effect of being so sick, even for those who recover. I mean, things don't just instantly go back to normal for some people. And I would add the string of science papers I've noticed about the long-term damage in people treated in intensive care units, including people on ventilators, which extreme cases of this coronavirus often require. What have you heard about that?
Well, it's well known that ventilation is a very high risk medical procedure. We only carry it out for the sickest individuals, and as you say, there can be long term complications. But generally, if there's infectious diseases, there can be what we call sequelae, things that come after the disease. So after any viral illness, for example, there's going to be tiredness for a period of time. Very often, you can get post viral depression. You just feel down, sometimes for a few months after a viral illness. And as well as that, viruses can damage particular parts of the body. So, for example, there's a virus called Coxsackie virus, which can damage the heart muscle. Other viruses can cause scarring in the lungs, for example, and cause lung problems later on. Now, this particular virus, it's not quite clear what sequelae they might be. There is some data that some people get damage to the heart with this virus. So it's possible that there could be cardiac sequelae. And there's also some evidence that it can cause scarring in the lungs in some people, perhaps due to excessive amounts of inflammation. So there could be ongoing lung damage and shortness of breath after the virus. Now, whether it affects other organs or not, we don't know. There's some people believe it can cause damage to the liver, and some people feel it might affect the kidneys. But I haven't read any scientific papers on that yet. But the risk of sequelae with a virus is always there. But the Chinese data does seem to be showing that people can make a full recovery. Because what we have to always bear in mind with the COVID-19 virus is the epidemiological evidence so far indicates that 80% of people will have a mild illness. They might be off work for a few days, but it's basically going to be mild and they should make a full recovery. And if you look on the Johns Hopkins website, the number of recovered patients is going up quite dramatically. Now, the Chinese started this, and their criteria for saying that a patient has recovered are actually quite exacting. The patient had to feel better. They had to have no fever for 10 days. They had to have an improving chest X-ray or CT scan. And they had to have 2 negative smears of the virus, showing that the body had cleared the virus. So it's actually quite a high bar for deciding whether someone was actually cured of this virus. So I would expect most people to make a full recovery and return to full health. But there could well be a minority of people, probably those who've got comorbidities or more severe disease, that do have longer-term sequelae of the virus yet. But the numbers of those have not yet been quantified. We would hope it would be fairly small.
So here in Canada, I'm a bit pessimistic. I feel we're miles behind. We have flights from Iran, Italy, and China still arriving daily. And when they come, the passengers are politely asked to self-isolate upon arrival. But we presume they take transit. They stay with families. Some will not comply. I worry we're being too polite, and that will lead to more deaths here. Plus, Canada, unlike Britain, has not published any plan. So we're all in the dark as to whether the government even has a plan.
I certainly think the government needs a plan, because there's no doubt in my mind that Canada will not be exempted from this pandemic. It's going to go everywhere unless something changes quite dramatically. Now, throughout this, I've been very disappointed with governments and the World Health Organization. and organizations like CDC in Atlanta for the lack of proactivity. They always seem to be reacting. So the World Health Organization would say, well, we'll stop flights to China if it becomes necessary. Even now, one of my chief health officers has said, there may come a time in England where we need to stop shaking hands, but that time is not yet. I disagree. I think we need to be changing our behavior now. We have to be anticipating the virus, because it has quite a long incubation period sometimes, and people are going to be shedding the virus in the incubation period. So I feel that a lot of governments and the World Health Organization have been reacting to events once they've happened, as indeed was the case to a large extent in Italy. But then you find lots of cases pop up because people have been incubating it and has been spread before the symptomatic cases developed. So I feel it's really time for Canada to start being proactive. I think you need to assume that the virus will be there in a few weeks' time and start behaving accordingly and taking appropriate measures now. And the fact that we're still doing so much international traveling just bemuses me, to be quite honest. And the fact that things are going on like mass participation events, it's almost like a form of denial that we'll start worrying about this virus when a lot of people start getting sick. But by that time, it's already spread. So the key thing is we need to switch from reactivity to proactivity. And that should be the mantra, I believe, of the World Health Organization and all world governments that are planning for this. Because what greater responsibility does a government have than to look after the health and well-being of its people?
As we wrap this up, John Campbell, is there anything else that you would like to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, I think we need to act together on this. This virus is a common enemy. We need to fight it as a combined humanity. We need to look after those that are vulnerable. We need to look after those that are sick. And we need to readjust our attitude, really, of how we are interacting with this world. If this acts as a wake-up call, that could be a good thing, because we depend on the ecology of our planet. We cannot live independently of it. We need to live with it in harmony. So if that teaches us a little bit of humility about the frailty of human life, that it can be taken away by infections and other environmental things at any time, then maybe we'll walk more softly on the surface of our planet, and that will be a good thing.
From the UK, we've been speaking with Dr. John Campbell, the man who has trained nurses in many countries and specialized in online teaching as well. He's doing it now via YouTube. I check it out every day. His site is campbellteaching.co.uk, campbellteaching.co.uk. Thank you, John, for generously stepping up to help us in this hour of need and speaking with us on Radio EcoShock.
It's been a pleasure, Alex. Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
That was the voice of founder and host of Radio EcoShock, Alex Smith, 14 years on the air, syndicated to around 100 mostly public radio stations. Radio EcoShock has become a vital information link to the latest climate science. Remember the link www.ecoshock.org and listen to the full one-hour show. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.